Okay, this is continuing with Hay of Autumn on 23rd May, 85.
Okay, well, we're talking about this solar brightness distribution. And we got so much better match that we thought we had something.
With limb brightening.
Limb brightening, and, limb brightening only in the equatorial direction and not in the other. And we thought that we were completely off the wall and everything. You know, we didn't know much about the astronomers. And then, but anyway, that became my thesis. And then in that same time frame, five or something like that, Christensen came through again. And he had then built this prominent flow.
Right.
And he showed pictures of Linda.
Yeah.
So what I did, I got these pictures and I took this, the silk, and ran it. The eclipse type operation, you know. We had all these graphic things. We didn't have computers at the time, you know, so we were by hand. And it matched pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we were happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't try to make a big discovery out of it, because of course Christians had done it independently and probably before we did.
Yeah. So the solar work was obviously of interest to the deck because it tied into the ionosphere.
Oh yes, that's what he did. As a matter of fact, I think that this interest in radio astronomy came through the solar work.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other solar experiments that were done at that time? Was there daily monitoring?
Yes, we did. We monitored all these frequencies after the eclipse, because the equipment was over there. Mm-hmm. We did, at that time, since I left in 57, you know, and nothing after that time had been published or been serious. I'm not that familiar with what happened after. I don't think much happened.
No, I get the impression that until the mid-60s, still continued like that.
Yeah, Rydbeck started holding it. Well, I can remember at the Ursi in Hague, was it?
54,
yeah, I was there. And Lovell presented his ideas for a 250-foot telescope, mm-hmm. that I thought was totally crazy. And also, a couple of years before, I had talked to Orch, visited him, and I was in Holland to look at these other things. And he told me about his plans for a 25-meter telescope, and I came home and I said, this is not going
to work. Even that?
Yeah, it was great at the time. But during that time frame, Rydberg became a builder. He got this idea that once I needed a large telescope. And that, by the time I left, it was in full swing trying to develop that idea.
Then came in the early 60s.
Yeah, it came in the early 60s. And he also got into solid state. That was actually before I left, and talked about laser amplifiers and so forth. And he had a way of being ahead of everybody else in the idea. But his execution was sort of fumbling, I think, in many ways. Either because, for example, the OH line. He talked about that when, at the time we got the first hydrogen line, he wanted us to build a mixer for OH. Hmm. Because there must be something there, he said.
Hmm.
And of course, even with that little telescope, as we know now, we could have found OH blasting in there.
Well, except the frequencies weren't well known.
No, but, that was the thing we could handle.
The search of light
that, that's right.
Range.
And we could build mixers. I mean, this was our strength.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he never got it. We built the mixer and then wanted to do the telescope.
For some reason. And I still think that when you talk to Bertel, he was more in on that than I was. I think he would claim that if we had put it on the telescope, we could have found the absorption.
Hmm.
Whatever, you know.
The hydrogen absorption? Or
The OH.
Oh, you mean OH absorption,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Mm-hmm. OH stuff, yeah. We could have discovered all that stuff that the Sandy Weinreben company discovered later. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I think that covers the Swedish part, unless there's something else that you...
No, I can't think of anything. We got, as I said, the main stimulus was visitors. We had Bolton came over once. Mm-hmm. I can remember that, and that was very exciting. And I can remember how Rydbeck wanted to milk him from information, so we sort of wanted to tape it. We had the wire recorders we had at the time, you know,
right.
All these things up, and he didn't want Bolton to know about it. All these things went on all the time. We had to figure out how he'd do. You see, Bolton's, the Australians were very good in equipment at the time. They had all these ideas, you know, with the to stabilize. That was the name of the game at the time. stable amplifiers. Mm-hmm.
So, what was your motivation to go to NRAO? What was the
attraction? Well, I knew Findlay. Findlay had visited. He was also Rudbeck. Everyone with a name had, was a friend of Rudbeck's. And Findlay came through again back in 53, 54, mm-hmm. that, about that time. And I was at Jodrell Bank. It was some symposium or some radio astronomy
54, thing. 54, 55, yeah, yeah, there something were two of them.
Yeah, yeah, there was something there. And Findlay was there, and I found out from him that he was going to the United States, you know, and the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. It was the first time I ever heard about some ideas about it in 55. It wasn't established then, but there were some ideas. I think there was a meeting in Washington in 54.
That's right. Yep.
That sort of started this rolling. And I knew Lloyd Berkner.
Quite well,
you know, from Rudbeck again. Yeah. Lloyd was over many times. He was a very good friend of Rudbeck's, and I was always involved in the visit. We went to dinner together and so forth. And Lloyd and I became very good friends. Well, he was much older than I, but never got friends in a sense, you know. And then Rudbeck went to the United States for a sabbatical, and I was sort of acting in his absence. Mm-hmm. Olving, you know, Olving, Sven Olving. He's now president of Chalmers. He and I actually shared that thing. Yeah, we were classmates and worked for it back there. And then I got the idea that I wanted to go over too, you know, and see what was going on there. And I asked him to make some arrangements for me if he could. And that's how I ended up.
Okay.
He called Findlay, and he realized, of course, that NRAO was nothing at the time, but he knew my interest was to build and dig ditches, mm-hmm. you know, as they thought that would fit. And so we went over and got here in October 58.
At Green Bank itself.
Green Bank itself. Right. We lived there for, I was a postdoc for a year and a half, you know, and it was just that period was the idea. And I went back to Sweden again for a few months. But before I left here, I was offered a job as head of the electronics division. So I turned around. Packed and came over more permanently.
So what did you find at Green Bank, and what did you begin working on?
In Green Bank, I found we came down the road, I remember, and we found this little old farmhouse next to the road there, and out that door came Heeshan. I had met Heeshan and Drake in Paris, mm-hmm. At the time where they already knew there must have been something going on in 58.
In 58, yeah. Paris Symposium.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I met them there, and I learned about Green Bank and so forth, you know, so. Heeshan came out and greeted me, and then I remember that Grote Reber came out. And to me, of course, he was God.
Mythological.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I was so impressed with the way he behaved and so forth. I was used to this European, right. you right. know what I mean, right? So, and then we worked down in a farmhouse. There were no buildings built by us at the time. There was nothing there. And we had a little lab in the farmhouse with two technicians. One of them is still with us, by the way. Dewey Ross is mm-hmm. working in Tucson. And I was supposed to work for Findlay, but he wasn't there. So I got a letter from Findlay that I still have, I can show you, suggesting things I might like to work on. And there was some receivers, you know, he wanted mm-hmm. to build. So I started with that, and in that building we had Frank Drake, Dave Heeshan, and Findlay. Heeshan and Findlay shared an office, and beat the sheets, who mm-hmm. still is yes. with us, and these two technicians and I, and that was NRAO at the time. Mm. Well, that's not quite true, that was the technical part of NRAO. And then we had another building, another farmhouse, where we had some business operations, Frank Callender and,
right. and so forth. But now there's still no antenna there.
No, no antenna. So Frank Drake had put up some low frequency stuff for Jupiter, I think. It's an interferometer, mm-hmm. corner reflector type with wires all over it. It was just, he played with
something
it.
Something to do.
Yeah, it's something to do. I think that's the right thing. Findlay had started building the little bighorn. And when he came back, I started working on switches. Front-end switches, sticky switches, you know, which using solid-state things, which hadn't been done before. I developed one that became sort of a standard switch for NRAO anyway. And then we got receivers. We had a Yuen Light, I think the company was called at the time.
Right.
Receiver for hydrogen line that, you know, nothing really worked at the time. Airborne Instrument Laboratory, AIL, had built a different kind of receiver, a sort of a noise compression type thing. And that drifted all over, and I tried to keep these things running, you know. And then we got the idea that let's build our own receiver instead of buying all these things. And at that time, the feeling was we should not, we NRIO should not build stuff, mm-hmm. we should buy. But for some reason, either because I convinced them or they found out on their own, I don't know, we sort of drifted into, we got to build it ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we built up a little lab, you know, we made what we call the standard receiver. It was a cheap way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And the 85-foot telescope was under construction at the time. The building was there when I came, that's true. The building for that was there. But the telescope wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that was put together, and so for them, to me, of course, that was a fantastic thing.
Right.
Big thing. And some engineers, we had an engineer at the AUI, actually, who felt that that telescope was so flimsy that it would fall down within 2 years.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. So he can't trust engineers either. And the 140-foot telescope was under construction, in the sense that they had just started fooling with it. And you know the story of the 140-foot, I guess, all the setbacks.
At the SETI symposium just a couple of days ago, we heard it yet again. You know, Frank Drake talked about the early years.
Did you see the film?
The delay. No.
There's a film where the whole reflector drops off the crane.
A film of it? Yeah. I didn't realize that.
We have a film, and we were all down there, and they tried to, there was a whole, you know, these two derricks we had to get, the whole thing was a mystery to me how it would work, and one slipped, and the whole thing.
You happened to be filming then.
And they also filmed the transportation of the main shaft. If you're interested in that kind of thing, you should try to get a hold of those.
Well, I have seen a film on the construction of the 140-foot, but I don't remember seeing the dropping.
Yeah, that was
interesting.
That should be in there. Maybe we don't want to show that anymore. What sort of a blunder?
Now, let me just ask you, going back to the little bighorn, as you called it, were there two horns for Cassay?
No.
It was just the one horn.
Yes, there was that long 128-foot horn.
Right.
And that was being built, and then that was Finley's project to do this absolute calibration.
Right, I talked to him about that.
Yeah. And then he wanted me involved in it, because he didn't want to do it alone. So I worked with him on that, and once it was all built, etc., we did the work. And that ended up as a publication.
Right.
By Finley and myself, and Bill Waltman, who was in on it.
Mm-hmm. About the standard flux of Cassay and so forth.
And we did everything over and over and over again, and we measured every night, you know, and we calibrated, and all these things sound easy today, but at that time it wasn't that easy to do that, to get an absolute calibration. And we did all kinds of things. We even used the 85-foot telescope to measure the background around Cass,
mm-hmm.
because it has a narrow beam, so we could sort of convolve the little bighorn beam with the actual map of Cass minus the source, you know, so you can get the...
Just Cass.
So you can get the result Cass only.
Yeah.
We did that. And the interesting thing, if you look at the paper, although we checked every figure 10,000 times, we were so mad at the whole paper in the end, the Finley said it has to be right. We were off by a factor of 10 to the 26th.
Oh.
we forgot that factor in the end. So...
It's better that than 20%.
That's right. We also discovered, I remember, that Cass changed, drifted, the intensity changed, dropped.
But this was after the result from Cambridge came out.
Oh, yes. Right. We didn't, sorry, I shouldn't say that we discovered it. That was wrong. We confirmed that discovery, but we did it through an absolute measurement.
Right.
We did not compare with the Cygnus.
And they were going back to observations 8 years before, so
you
had much more accurate data, shorter baseline, but you could actually see the effect.
We could see the effect without comparing with other source, because I think the problem that, the question I was asked at the time was, which of the two, what is it that varies? You know, mm-hmm. and Tahitian had this 42-foot thing, where he did the, you remember that transit telescope in Green Bank, where he did long-term comparison between a number of sources, I forget which they were.
Mm-hmm. And what about that?
I forget now what came out of that.
And Cassay was one of them.
Yeah, Cassay, I think, was one of them, Cygnus, and then the Taurus. Well, you know, the general sources at the time, I think.
But what was the purpose of the 40-foot? Was that?
No, it was just to do that, the comparison, long-term comparison of the intensity of sources.
That was the main reason that the antenna was built?
Yes. That was because Hieschen wanted an antenna, a cheap antenna, that could stand there undisturbed. So it was totally automatic.
Too, I see.
And as a matter of fact, I can remember we made a test there by, we had a thermal problem in the lab, so this time we experimented by digging a hole in the ground and making an underground laboratory. You have seen it, haven't you?
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's just right. Dug under. And it turned out to be successful. It was a very stable temperature in there.
Mm-hmm. You haven't mentioned Otto Struve.
No.
Was he there when you arrived?
No. He wasn't there. The director of NRIO was Lloyd Burton. He made himself acting director.
Did he work at the site, or was he?
No. He was, he was one of the big
right.
wheels.
That's what I thought. In absentia, director.
Yeah, there was no director. I mean, there were Findlay, Heeshan, and Drake and myself. Mm-hmm. And we were sort of drifting around, having a good time. That's all there was at the time.
And so, when Struve arrived, what, a year later after you arrived?
Yeah. Yes, he did. He actually arrived. Either just when I went back to Sweden, or when I was there, because he was the director when I came back again.
Right. Now, did that change the mode of operation there? Did that change
Not
the atmosphere
really.
In any way?
But yes, it became more observatory, but it didn't change anything that I can think of.
What do you see his role as in the couple of years that he was there? Was it really pretty minimal, or do you think that he had a major influence of some kind? From my point of view,
I don't think there was anything to remember about what he did. It was stability, I think, was more. I don't think he fit in completely. He was an old timer and an optical man, and he was a good guy, and we liked him, and I think he.
But you knew nothing about radio techniques.
No. He didn't know anything about that, but, and of course, at that time we had the first troubles with 140 foot, and that probably kept him busy too. You know,
right.
And he wasn't the kind of man I think he would like to deal with those kind of problems. So, I in my view, Otto's tenure as director doesn't stand out as being anything particularly good or bad or anything like that. I might forget something, but.
But now that only lasted until 61, I guess
yeah,
it was.
Then Pawsey.
And then the Pawsey story.
Yeah, and I remember I was so happy because I knew Pawsey quite well from before. And when he came, he and I traveled up to AIL, I remember, to look at something that we were supposed to go. So we went up to New York, and he had something else to do there, and all of a sudden I got the call, and he said I didn't feel too well, and he couldn't go. So I went to AIL. I thought he had a cold or something like that. And then later, he was back in Green Bank again, and for a few days, he wasn't officially the director yet. I think he hadn't taken effect, so to speak, yet. And then we learned about his serious illness.
Right.
And I think Bill Sweet, who is one of the trustees of AUI, who is a brain surgeon at Boston General Hospital, got involved in this, And
he did go to Boston.
Yeah, and I remember that. Sort of in confidence, Bill Sweet told us that there's nothing that could be done about it. Mm. And he died quite...
very soon after he went back to Australia in a few months.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And then, of course, came that interesting period where they were searching for a director, and I was part of some of those meetings, and I was... Robbie, of course, was the driving force in AUI at the time. And they were searching all over for a director, and all of a sudden, Robbie, out of the blue, probably not out of the blue, but from my point of view, it was, decided that he should be acting director. Well, it was fine with me. But that was sort of surprising. After we had...
were looking for some of the Pawsey's
The Pawsey, Struve kind of level,
right.
And here was a young guy fresh out of school, so to speak,
Right.
And... It didn't take long for me to realize that he had made a good choice. Mm. There's no question about it. And then, of course, as you know, he became permanent director
right,
his next
year,
fall, I think.
A year later,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking over those early 60s years, once you had an 85-foot dish, and I guess you were building receivers.
Yes.
Primarily for that dish, as well as working with the horn there. What do you remember as the outstanding events of that time? And of course, you weren't participating in the scientific results so much, but still.
The most exciting thing for me was the Jupiter thing. Because Frank and I were neighbors up there, and we were good friends, and we talked a lot about things like that, and he probably taught me more about radio astronomy than anyone else. And he came one day and he said, you know, I think it was Slonecker had discovered something at 10 centimeters.
Right, an excess of radiation.
Yeah, that's right, there was something wrong.
10 centimeters, more than you expected from thermal.
That's right, I think Frank called it, there was something wrong with Jupiter. And I didn't catch on, this whole thing didn't mean all that much to me. But then he said he did some measurement at 21 centimeters, and we had a horn on the field horn on the 85 foot that combined 21 and 3. There was a coaxial arrangement there. And he came to me and he said, we got the measure at a much lower frequency. Could you make a feed for 400, 450, that thereabout, that I can use on this telescope at the same time I have the 21 centimeter feed on, so we can do comparisons? I said, sure, we can do that. And I started, I built it with my own hands, cutting up a big thing and put these dipoles on. And the trick, of course, was to do it so that it didn't disturb the pattern of the other frequencies, and at the same time had the right pattern, all these kind of things, and match and so forth. So it took me about a week or two, I guess, to get that done. And then we put it up on the telescope, and to my surprise, I was more surprised than anyone, it worked, without any more problems. And then the first night we had it up there, Frank said, let's try. So we went down there and we went on, off, Jupiter, on, off, And you could see it, It wasn't anything you had to fish out of the noise. Right. It was really strong, and he was very, very excited about the whole thing.
This is 68 centimeters, apparently, looking at
that. Yeah, it's 440 megahertz, I think it was, we did some quick calculation, and Jupiter set, I remember, so it all disappeared. And we did some very quick calculations I think the brightness temperature must have been 30,000 degrees or something of that sort. And Frank said, boy, we have really gotten onto something here. And we continued those measurements for some time, and everything matched, So then there was a Ursi in London.
That's right, 1960.
Yeah, and I was there. I mean, I left that fall, to go back to Sweden after we had done these measurements. And I was there, and somehow there was some other person who had done something similar, claimed that our results were wrong. I forget now who that was. And Frank and I, we just couldn't understand what was wrong with it. And when I came back again, we measured again, and it had changed. And Frank claimed that that had to do with, well, first of all, his idea with the Van Allen belt came up at that time. And he claimed it had to do with the fact that there was a burst. There had been a flare on the sun the right number of days
before
we happened to meet Jupiter at that time, and so forth. So all these things matched. But I was still concerned about the whole thing, So I went back and measured what we called anti-Jupiter. It is the point where Jupiter was at the time we did the measurements.
Right.
And there was a little bump there.
A little radio source.
Yeah, right. So I mapped that whole thing very carefully and subtracted that map. And now we got, still there was an enhancement. There was no question about it. But now the curve wasn't going like that. It was more,
reduced it considerably.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And then we, at some stage around here, we said we had to publish it, but I'm not the writing kind, and at that time I don't think Frank wanted to write it either, so we talked about it and kept teasing each other, have you written anything? I said, no, have you written anything? But he published it. The only publication we ever came up with was the abstract for a meeting of AAA or something.
Right, it was, the meeting was in August 59.
Yeah, that is the only publication that ever came out of that measurement.
Because you didn't quite have the confidence.
That's right. Well, and once we got the confidence, we didn't want to do anything more about it. I think if either Frank or I had been excited enough at that time to write something about it, I think we would have done it if we never did.
Well, in closing, let me ask you about the concept of a national observatory versus, which was a new idea relative to other radio astronomy groups. Now, talking only now about those first 5 years at Green Bank or so, do you think it worked well or not? Or what do you see as the pros and cons of
the idea of a national observatory at that stage as opposed to a university group or something like Chalmers?
Yeah, I think that it has potential for disaster in the sense that, as has happened with other institutions of this kind, they become their own thing. And I think that, without knowing it, I think that NRAO was, in a way, on the wrong track in the beginning, because we had all the money, and we could do whatever we wanted. We were actually swimming in money, and it wasn't that much at the time, but relative to what we were able to do and the people we had, there was nothing we could just get right into. And I think that there's a potential disaster in these kind of things, and I think it was Hessian, and only his ideas and how he pushed the user concept that we are a service organization for the users and with the users committee and get the users involved. And also this idea of having our own scientists compete with the outside on an equal basis. They had no privilege. He saw to it that there were absolutely no privilege or no advantage of being on NRAO staff except that you were here.
Right.
I mean, that you can't do much about.
For access to telescope time.
No, more access at all. As a matter of fact, I think that he mentioned that occasion in private, but that his idea was that the size of the staff of NRAO should be adjusted in the long run so that they only got 25-30% of the time.
Mm.
And he didn't ever want to decide that. The goal was 25-30%. And he was too high, he didn't hire people. He was too low, he hired people. And that's the way you can make it totally... democratic is not the word, but you know what I mean. Yeah.
But now this is getting more into the 60s.
No, he started that way
right from the beginning.
I think that was sort of an idea he felt. I think he saw the danger himself.
But let's discuss this danger you're referring to. You had lots of money. You're a small group of young radio astronomers. And what is the danger precisely?
The danger is that the NRA or such a national center can dominate the whole thing and take all the money. And we have been criticized for being rich. You know, a university has a grant for $200,000.
Still today, the argument's going.
Yeah, right, yeah. But I think today they realize that the VLA, those instruments, could not exist.
Right.
Without.
But nevertheless, the arguments still go on. But
no.
At that time, you're saying even then, there would be the argument.
The argument was coming up.
Why should they get such a high amount of money per person?
I think there was a wait-and-see period in the early stages where the university people felt this is probably the right way of doing it. Let's see what happens. Boy, they have a lot of money up there. We are struggling here. But let's be quiet for a while and see what happens. Let them give them a chance. And I think that if Hessian hadn't become director, I shouldn't say that, but if some director hadn't seen that, I think NRAO could have been a sort of a center of excellence in science in its own right, and sort of to the exclusion of these outside thing. And I think with the referee system we have and all that Hessian introduced, I think we made it.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, with you.
That ends the interview with Hein Havadim on 23rd May 1985.